Many of you perhaps have at one time or another seen the play or the film of Oscar Wilde, The Picture of Dorian Gray. In that dark drama of a soul almost lost and at the last minute reprieved, there is a moment when a kind friend says to the hero, "Here's a copy of The Light of Asia. It may save you, it may help you. It's the life of a good man." But that such a remark should have been made somewhere in the last quarter of the 19th century in England, in the middle of a literary work of art by a man who was not religious in our sense of the word, is due to the life and work of Sir Edwin Arnold. Within the theosophical tradition, The Light of Asia has a definite place, because all students of theosophy remember that when their teacher, Madame Blavatsky, made a will, she mentioned that if friends and students wished to gather to remember her on an anniversary, they should read from two books, the Bhagavad Gita and The Light of Asia. So great was the appreciation, the respect for this book, which of course, as you all know, is a long poem. The whole book is one long poem. In fact, until Mr. Judge wrote and gave us his rendition of the Bhagavad Gita, students of theosophy often used a translation of the Gita also made by Sir Edwin Arnold called the Song Celestial. And it's well worth consulting. At some points in the notes on the Bhagavad Gita by Judge, you will find that he quotes the Gita in the lines of that translation. Because of this, perhaps it will not be out of place to preface our study by thinking a little of how others have thought of this poem and a little about Sir Edwin Arnold himself. Gandhiji said this about The Light of Asia: "I read The Light of Asia with even greater interest than I did the Bhagavad Gita. Once I had begun it, I could not leave off." Nehru said, "The Buddha's story attracted me even in early boyhood, and Edwin Arnold's The Light of Asia became one of my favorite books." And the very fine American writer Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, "It's a work of great beauty. It tells a story of intense interest which never flags for a moment. Its descriptions are drawn by the hand of a master with the eye of a poet. Its tone is so lofty that there is nothing with which to compare it but the New Testament. It is full of variety, now picturesque, now pathetic, now rising into the noblest realms of thought and aspiration." Such was the response to The Light of Asia, which was originally published in 1879. This was after Sir Edwin Arnold had published translations based on the Hitopadesha in 1861, Jayadeva's Gita Govinda, 1875, and before he published the translation which we mentioned, the translation of the Gita as the Song Celestial, that came out in 1885. We realize therefore that he was more or less a contemporary of HPB and the first generation of the Theosophical movement. In fact, he died a little later than HPB. He died in 1904. he came to India very young, in 1856, as the principal of Deccan College in Pune. And it's remarkable that in 1861, 5 years after he'd been in Pune, and please note, 4 years after the traumatic experience of the Indian mutiny, which changed the relationships between Englishmen and Indians in India drastically. Well, in 1861, this young author, or rather this young teacher, wrote something very striking. He wrote, "A long residence in India and close intercourse with her people have given the author a lively desire to subserve their advancement. No one now listens to the precipitate ignorance which would set aside as heathenish the high civilization of this great race. But justice is not yet done to their past development and present capacities." This is a young Englishman writing in 1861, just 4 years after the battles of the mutiny. A very remarkable mind. And one might say that so much of the rest of his life and work was devoted to securing for what he called Indians, this great race and its high civilization. His writings tried to secure justice for them, recognition in the Western world. There are some things which we should notice from his own preface to The Light of Asia. He says in the following poem, "I have sought by the medium of an imaginary Buddhist votary to depict the life and character and indicate the philosophy of that noble hero and reformer, Prince Gautama of India, the founder of Buddhism." So please note what he had in mind: life and character and philosophy. The Buddha's life, character and philosophy. And he tried to do this in a poem. When he says by the medium of an imaginary Buddhist votary, we must understand that this is how he cast the poem into form. He does not speak in his own person. The person who speaks is an imaginary devotee of the Buddha. It's as if this devotee is telling the story or expressing his feelings of reverence towards the Buddha and so on. And this is why in the devotional reading which we heard, that reading actually forms the last few verses of The Light of Asia. It is this imaginary Buddhist devotee who is saying, "Here endeth what I write, who loved the master for his love of us." But of course that also is true about Sir Edwin Arnold himself. And he goes on, "A little knowing, little have I told, touching the teacher and the ways of peace." It is not a claim to a full statement of the Buddha's teaching. And in fact, in his prose preface, Arnold also speaks equally reverently towards the Buddha, but very humbly about his own knowledge and how much he has been able to depict in the poem. But remember that he was a poet. We mentioned his earlier poetic works. In fact, as a young student at Oxford, he got what is called the Newdigate Prize for Poetry. That's one of the most distinguished prizes for poetry that a young poet can get in England. And so he brought all this trained ability to handle language and handle imagery to his task. You never see in The Light of Asia any struggle with language. That part of it comes easy to him, naturally to him. And what he has absorbed from the Buddhist tradition, he says frankly, all right, here and there are controversies among the erudite. And he says those who know Buddhist scholarship, of course he's talking about 1879, they will be aware that I have taken the imperfect Buddhistic citations much as they stand in Spence Hardy's work, and have also modified more than one passage in the received narratives. The views, however, here indicated of nirvana, dharma, karma, and other chief features of Buddhism are at least the fruits of considerable study and also of a firm conviction that a third of mankind, this is his estimate of how many people have been influenced by the Buddha's teaching, and also of a firm conviction that a third of mankind would never have been brought to believe in blank abstractions or in nothingness as the issue and crown of being. Finally, in reverence to the illustrious promulgator of this light of Asia, meaning the Buddha, and in homage to the many eminent scholars who have devoted noble labors to his memory, for which both repose and ability are wanting to me, I beg that the shortcomings of my too hurried study may be forgiven. It has been composed in the brief intervals of days without leisure, but is inspired by an abiding desire to aid in the better mutual knowledge of East and West. This was the poet, the author, who nevertheless spoke or speaks in the poem, not in his own person, but through the dramatic projection of a Buddhist devotee. If you keep this in mind, you realize that the very first lines of the poem are significant. And in the very first lines of the poem, we have a heading, as it were, in verse. The scripture of the Savior of the world, Lord Buddha, Prince Siddhartha styled on earth, in earths and heavens and hills incomparable, all honored, wisest, best, most pitiful, the teacher of Nirvana and the law. And the first actual line of the narrative is, then came he to be born again for men. Now, as a poet, Edwin Arnold shows a continuous awareness of two things which are very, very oriental. In fact, in his preface, which deserves complete reading, he points out that he thought it was impossible for someone to appreciate the life and teachings of the Buddha unless he first entered sympathetically into the oriental point of view. The whole Western point of view, as it were, was not adequate or appropriate if you wish to appreciate the teaching of the Buddha. Now, this oriental point of view, Edwin Arnold has absorbed to such an extent that you see two things throughout this poem at various points. One, a living sense in his mind that though we're talking about something which happened on earth, there are other lokas, other worlds which coexist and which intercommunicate with life on earth, that human beings are not alone. And so right at the beginning, when he says the Buddha came to be born again for men, why again? Because he then begins in an extremely traditional way. And some of these references may not be clear to those not familiar with Buddhist mythology, but to students of the secret doctrine, they will be very, very suggestive. Below the highest sphere, four regents sit who rule our world. And under them are zones nearer but high, where saintliest spirits dead wait thrice 10,000 years, then live again. And on Lord Buddha, waiting in that sky, came for our sakes the 5 sure signs of birth, so that the devas knew the signs and said, Buddha will go again to help the world.
So the story begins not here, but where the four regents sit. Students of the secret doctrine will think at once about the four Maharajas, and later on there are references to the regents which will make us think of the Lipika. But this sense of great souls on other planes, looking at life on earth and concern for human beings, is always present in his mind. And another thing always present in his mind is a kind of nature as something living, nature that responds to what is going on at the deeper levels of human life. That is why, again, very early in the poem, the queen Maya is about to have that baby. He begins, "Queen Maya stood at noon, her days fulfilled, under a palasa in the palace grounds, a stately trunk straight as a temple shaft, with crown of glossy leaves and fragrant blooms, and knowing the time come for all things new, the conscious tree bent down its boughs to make a bower above Queen Maya's majesty." The conscious tree. There is an echo there of the sort of thing that you find in the Voice of the Silence. Students will remember the end of the Voice of the Silence. "Hark, from the deep unfathomable vortex of that golden light in which the victor bathes, all nature's wordless voice in thousand tones arises to proclaim, joy unto ye, O men of Malabar. A pilgrim hath returned back from the other shore, a new Arhan is born." That when a great spiritual event happens in human life, the whole of nature on the higher planes responds. The Voice of the Silence, of course, is a great text in the Buddhist tradition also. So we mentioned these two things which mark Edwin Arnold's writing: the awareness of other planes and worlds and great beings concerned with human life, and of the response of living nature at all times. You get the same kind of thing from him at the point where he describes the Buddha arising from that great meditation which produced final enlightenment. "Lo, the dawn sprang with Buddha's victory. Lo, in the east flamed the first fires of beauteous day, pour forth through fleeting holes of night's black drapery. High in the widening blue, the herald star faded to paler silver, as there shot brighter and brighter bars of rosy gleam across the grey." And then the beautiful description of nature happy, and birds and animals, all of these, this goes on for more than a page. Now, perhaps to the 20th century contemporary mind, this is a little uncomfortable. We have not the patience to read descriptions of this kind. We don't always respond. But it's a very sincere insight, a very sincere feeling. And therefore, this long description ends, it may sound merely poetic and merely sentimental, but it ends by quoting something which actually you find in the Dhammapada. "Then he arose, radiant, rejoicing, strong, beneath the tree, and lifting high his voice, spake this, 'In hearing of all times and worlds.'" Now, that is something that a student of theosophy would think about. That when a great one, when a master of spiritual wisdom speaks, he does not speak only in that place and for those people who are present. That vibration goes into the akasha and is therefore influential in all the lokas, all the planes of this universe, and it remains there while this universe continues. So the poet's intuition is stating a very exact fact. spake this in hearing of all times and words. And what he said, he quotes in the original Pali, which presents difficulties because Roman transliteration in Sir Edwin Arnold's time of Pali was not so simple. But the translation he provides is beautiful and in fact has been adopted in our edition of the Dhammapada. Many a house of life hath held me, seeking ever him who wrought these prisons of the senses, sorrow fraught. Sore was my ceaseless strife. But now, thou builder of the tabernacle, thou, I know thee, never shalt thou build again these walls of pain, nor raise the roof tree of deceits, nor lay fresh rafters on the clay. Broken thy house is, and the rich pole split. Delusion fashioned it. Safe pass I thence, deliverance to obtain. The strength, the confidence of those words show how deeply the poet has appreciated what constitutes spiritual freedom. Because this is a soul saying that all those causes which bind a human soul to rebirth have now been overcome. That is what it amounts to. It's said in simple and majestic words, and perhaps a little more might still be said about the poetic quality of Edwin Arnold speaking of the Buddha. In the first place, he has a very dignified simplicity in his writing of this kind. Very early in the poem, he has to speak of the death of Buddha's mother, which occurred within days of the Buddha's birth. This is how he puts it. A great ascetic prophesies to her, tells her that this is going to happen. Thou sweet queen, dear to all gods and men for this great birth, henceforth are grown too sacred for more woe, and life is woe. Therefore in 7 days, painless thou shalt attain the close of pain. This is what we meant by saying that his command of language, his mastery of poetic form was already established. Without effort, he says a line like, painless thou shalt attain the close of pain. He said all that needs to be said. He said it with dignity and with very simple words, adding no sentimental complications at all. Similarly, many of you will remember that a beautiful incident where after the Buddha had worn himself out with ascetic practices and began to feel, but my body is, now I realize that this is not the right way, but my body is perhaps going to give way before I can try another way and reach enlightenment. And that very kind village housewife, Sujata, the wife of the Patil there, gave him very special sattvic food, as we might say. And then there is a little conversation between them. He is grateful. He explains that he's only a man, not a god. She thinks he's a god, but he knows that he says he's not. And he asks her, I shall find the light. Yea, now it dawned glorious and helpful when my weak flesh failed, which this pure food, fair sister, hath restored. Then he says, yet dost thou truly find it sweet enough, meaning your life, yet dost thou truly find it sweet enough only to live? Can life and love suffice? And look at the way Edwin Arnold puts her answer. Answered Sujata, worshipful, my heart is little, and a little rain will fill the lily's cup. Now, only a poet of the first order, at least, I mean, he's not always a poet of the first order, but that moment he's a poet of the first order, to say all, you visualize a simple, kindly woman speaking to the Buddha, or at least the one who's going to become enlightened in the next day, and stating the simple human point of view. My heart is little, and a little rain will fill the lily's cup. And the Buddha accepts it, gives her child a blessing, and goes on. Then, on a different note, when the Buddha decides to discard formal religion and not to support them, speaking of what people do in the way of offerings to the gods and so on, he says, those litanies of flattery and fear, that is what your prayers are, that is what your ceremonies and offerings are. Those litanies of flattery and fear. But again, think of the poet who found that simple phrase to sum up what ordinary religious behavior amounts to. Flattery and fear towards the gods. There are times when he can use a single word with tremendous effect. You already saw describing the thing about Queen Maya, how he said, the conscious tree. That communicates the whole philosophical doctrine of consciousness throughout nature. Similarly, at a sweet and simple moment, when the wedding is finally settled between Yashodhara and Siddhartha, Edwin Arnold writes, and on his breast she laid her perfect head. The use of the word perfect there lifts the line from sentiment to poetry. It's just the one use of the word, as in another great case, Shakespeare once used the word bright and changed the whole line, but never mind. Then, when the Buddha has seen what sickness and old age are like, and he speaks to Yashodhara, and she's naturally tending to become sad, Edwin Arnold finds, again, very simple words, but very definite words. Yet, whatsoever fall to thee and me, be sure I loved and love Yashodhara. That delicate use of the two tenses, I loved and love Yashodhara, that does it. And again, in the same passage, I loved thee most because I loved so well all living souls. That is Siddhartha, not any ordinary fond husband. I loved thee well because I loved so well all living souls. And of course, we are all familiar with the philosophical phrase which he found for the end of Attavada or egoism, where he says, losing self, the universe grows I. That's a whole philosophical complication about anatta and the meaning of self and so forth. The poet has crossed that difficult bridge by simply saying, the universe grows I. So this is kind of thing. Then there is a sense that the poem always has of the culture that surrounded the future Buddha as a young boy, as a prince, and the culture which was within him as a soul already pure and refined. For example, we have that little traditional incident when he's sent to a teacher and the teacher says, shall I teach you this? And he says, if you please, sir, let me recite. And in fact, he goes far beyond what the teacher could teach, and so on. But he's respectful. And the teacher says, thou knowest all without the books, and knowest fair reverence besides. Now, a whole culture is poured into these two lines. And when you realize that it was a young Englishman who did it, it's an astonishing achievement. Thou knowest all without the books, and knowest fair reverence besides. At another point, the Buddha says, when he realizes how much the animals in the farmland suffer, Edwin Arnold makes him say, that I shall teach compassion unto men, and be a speechless world's interpreter. the animals who can't speak for themselves, you see. I shall teach compassion unto men and be a speechless world's interpreter. Another aspect of that culture is the sense which we already saw of the presence of great beings and their concern with the human world. So there is one, again, traditional incident. You know that business of Devadatta and Buddha both claiming the herd swan and the courtiers not being able to decide. And an old ascetic, not known, turns up and decides the issue. And then when the king wants to make him a present, he's not there. And Edwin Arnold puts it from a traditional source. And someone saw a hooded snake glide forth. The gods come oft times thus. Now, that anybody who is not an Indian wrote this, it's extraordinary. And of course, the student of theosophy would realize that there has always been this subtle play on the hooded snake, Naga, and the Nagas. Nagarjuna, who received wonderful instruction, there is a wonderful footnote about it in the Voice of the Silence. Nagarjuna, who received wonderful instruction from the Nagas. So, all that comes into very in very simple and traditional forms into Edwin Arnold's poetry. Now the great steps in the Buddha's life are rendered when he sees for the first time an old tottering man. Well, we know what Buddha said philosophically, we know the four truths. But how does the poet go about it? He makes the Buddha ask his charioteer this question. And it represents such a jump and sweep of the imagination that you see something like that and the first question he makes the Buddha ask is, but shall this come to others or to all? Or is it rare that one should be as he? That imagination which grasps the human situation as a whole. And afterwards, speaking to Yashodhara, he says, "Ah, sweet, such comfort." She says, "But don't you get any comfort? You're saddened by the sight of all this, but don't you get any comfort from our love, from our home?" And what he says, "Ah, sweet, such comfort that my soul aches, thinking it must end. For it will end." He's seen it at one stroke. He has seen this. Just from one example. That this is the problem. It's not that mankind does not sometimes have happy days. But they are always under the shadow of an end. After all, this is the beginning of the tragic insight. The same way he responds to sickness and death. There are very fine passages where Edwin Arnold at once reveals Buddha's teaching and his character at one stroke. He's combining the two. This is what happens. After having seen the three sides, this is what he makes the Buddha say. The veil is rent which blinded me. I am as all these men who cry upon their gods and are not heard or are not heeded. Yet there must be aid for them and me and all. There must be help. Perchance the gods have need of help themselves, being so feeble that when sad lips cry, they cannot save. I would not let one cry whom I could save. How can it be that Brahm would make a world and keep it miserable, since if all powerful he leaves it so, he is not good, and if not powerful, he is not God? Channa, lead home again. That's the charioteer. Channa, lead home again. It's enough. Mine eyes have seen enough. Now in those less than a dozen lines, you have the character, the philosophy, the criticism of the personal God idea in his mature teaching. The Buddha listed belief in a personal God as one of the specific hindrances to spiritual wisdom. it's one of the obstacles to be overcome. All that, without fuss, without technical language, it's been put. By the way, the meter is unfaltering, and that's the UAT is not a place to study meter, but the meter is unfaltering throughout these lines. It's mostly blank verse, but where it changes occasionally, we feel the change, but it goes smooth, it's easy, there's no difficulty about it, and yet all these philosophical points have been made swiftly and easily there. And then again, when he is getting ready for his quest, we have this beautiful passage. He's thinking about human misery again. What good gift have my brothers, but it came from search and strife and loving sacrifice. If one then, being great and fortunate, rich, dowered with health and ease, from birth designed to rule, if he would rule a king of kings, if one not tired with life's long day, but glad in the freshness of its morning, one not cloyed with love's delicious feasts, but hungry still, if one not worn and wrinkled, sadly sage, but joyous in the glory and the grace that mix with evils here, and free to choose earth's loveliest at his will, one even as I, who ache not, lack not, grieve not, save with griefs which are not mine, except as I am man, if such a one, having so much to give, gave all, laying it down for love of men, and thenceforth spent himself to search for truths, wringing the secret of deliverance forth, whether it lurk in hells or hide in heavens, or hover unrevealed nigh unto all. Surely at last, far off, sometimes, somewhere, the veil would lift for his deep searching eyes, the road would open for his painful feet. That should be one for which he lost the world, and death might find him conqueror of death. This will I do, who have a realm to lose, because I love my realm. Because my heart beats with each throb of all the hearts that ache, known and unknown, those that are mine and those which shall be mine, 1,000,000,000 more, saved by this sacrifice I offer now. O summoning stars, O mournful earth, for thee and thine I lay aside my youths, my throne, my joys, my golden days, my nights, my happy palace, and thine arms, sweet queen, harder to put aside than all the rest. Yet thee too I shall save, saving this earth. So, this, again, says all that it was necessary to say in terms of the philosophy of the quest on which he went. It took him 6 years from the time he left the palace to the time he attained enlightenment. The philosophy of that quest is said in this speech. Again, simply, directly, the character and the philosophy are so fused together that they are not separate. You can't take them apart. The title of our study today was Buddha, Dhamma and Poetry. But it is the achievement of Sir Edwin Arnold that the three are not separate. At least cannot be totally separated in this poem. They fuse so completely. You know that during the quest, there was that time when he visited the court of King Bimbisara and stopped the sacrifice of many animals. At that point, Sir Edwin Arnold has some words that he puts in his mouth. Nor speak he, shall one wash his spirit clean by blood, that is by offering those sacrifices. Nor, spake he, shall one wash his spirit clean by blood, nor gladden gods, being good, with blood, nor bribe them, being evil. name, nor lay upon the brow of innocent bound beasts one hair's weight of that answer all must give, for all things done amiss or wrongfully, alone, each for himself, reckoning with that the fixed arithmetic of the universe, which meeteth good for good and ill for ill, measure for measure, unto deeds, words, thoughts, watchful, aware, implacable, unmoved, making all futures fruits of all the pasts. If you want a statement of the philosophy of karma, there it has been done in 7 or 8 lines. And this is not a translation. This is a distillation. Having studied many Buddhist sutras and sayings, the poet put this into one speech. It's magnificently said. And there's at least one phrase there that might very well have been written by Shakespeare or Keats themselves. The fixed arithmetic of the universe. We speak of the law which cannot be caused to turn aside, caused to deviate by any form of propitiation and so forth. The fixed arithmetic of the universe is a tremendous poet's phrase which fixes that idea. If we are looking at it in more Indian terms, which there will not be time to do, the student was tempted to look at it that way and made some notes, but there won't be time for it. If you were to do it in terms of the rasas, you will find that not only shanta, which you would expect in such a poem on such a subject, but vira and karuna come into it in a tremendous way. The vira rasa and the karuna. The vira rasa comes into it very oddly at the moment of what Buddhist tradition calls the maha abhinishkramana, the great going forth of the Buddha from his personal life. And it comes in a speech addressed to his horse Kantaka. There won't be time to read all those things. There is also a lovely use of traditional anecdotes. Like when he was nearly fainting, he asks a low caste boy, a shepherd boy, to give him milk. And the boy gives it by making his goat stand near the fainting Buddha and milking it directly into his mouth. But that's a few drops. And he says, no, but give me it in your lota. And the boy says, but sir, I'm of this low caste and how can I? And the few lines that Erwin Aronson has written there, representing the Buddha, speaking those lines and denying the validity of caste. Those lines. And the use of those anecdotes. And of course, the anecdote about Suchata's food. The well-known anecdote about the dancing girls who looked at him and sang a song about tune the sitar neither high nor low, otherwise the string will break. That he has used very well. The anecdote that before he left the palace, the devas in the air reminded him that this was due. There Edwin Arnold has exerted his technical skill to produce a song in a different meter from the rest of the poem. We are the voices of the wandering winds. And the handling of alliteration and the meter there produces a completely different sound from the rest of the poem. And of course, students will remember how he has dealt with the description, the tremendous description of that long night in which he goes through stage after stage of insight and meditation. And temptations arise. The dealings with the temptations. One of them is that Mara projects an image of Yashodhara, longing for him and sort of trying to hold him back on both counts. His love for her and her own beauty and attractiveness. And of course the Buddha recognizes that this is a delusion, a hallucination. And he says, for the dear sake of her whose shape thou wearest, I do not curse you. Melt into your nothingness. Tremendous phrase. Not till 150 years later did Tolkien use comparable language in which also a sage commands an evil spirit to disappear. This is tremendously done. Now, that was the use of temptations and traditions and so on. And then there is one passage in which you remember he dares to sum up what was the insight that the Buddha got. Now, this is difficult. Because after all, it is not a Buddha or even an Arhat writing the poem. It is done only by devoted study of the tradition. And perhaps the whole passage would be too long, but some of it we should recall in the sixth book. And in the middle watch, our Lord attained abhijna. Insight vast. By the way, insight vast is itself a wonderful translation for the word abhijna. Our Lord attained abhijna. Insight vast, ranging beyond this sphere to spheres unnamed. System on system, countless worlds and suns moving in splendid measures, band by band, linked in division, one yet separate. The silver islands of a sapphire sea, shoreless, unfathomed, undiminished.